The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them. This is the show for September 20th, 2012, and it's about being a free agent.
So, Chris, do you ever wish you could pick the projects you get to work on?
Yeah, on those days when it's, when the project's not going well and, I'm kind of down on what I'm doing, I definitely feel that. I'm like, yeah, I wish I could have. I never would have picked this one, right? I would have picked much better. But
that's part of the reason they call a job is you have to do what people want you to do, not what necessarily we're wishing for.
Right, exactly. And I always like that saying, too, about, you hate your job? We have a therapy group for that. We meet at the bar on Fridays.
Right.
But yeah, like you said, it's called a job for a reason, because it's work, right? And so you don't always get to pick what you're doing. And I've said before, and I have friends who say the same, if you don't like what you're doing at work, you go home and you do what you like when you're at home. Like you work on electronics, you work on mechanical stuff, or whatever you want to do, you got to kind of, if you really want to do it, you got to find time in your own life, which sounds kind of counterintuitive. Right.
But there's a reason people look for jobs and hang on to jobs. We all like the idea of a steady paycheck and health benefits and, somebody telling us, what has to be done next. We're not left just wondering where the money's going to come from. And so that's sort of the trade-off. You get a job and you get that sense of stability and security, but you lose a certain amount of autonomy.
Right, exactly. And that's the trade-off everyone makes. And it goes both directions, right? It's not always, you don't have to get a full-time job. There's a lot of other options. And today, our guest is one of those people. And not only that, he's actually quite new to the job market, so it's interesting because it's kind of a fresh look on the whole thing. And who do we have today?
Well, our guest is Stephen Kesich. Did I get that right?
Yep, you got that right.
Oh, terrific. Well, welcome, Stephen.
Hi, thank you.
So, Stephen, could you tell us a little bit about kind of your journey and where you are in the engineering world and maybe how it all fits into this getting to pick what you work on and just the kind of work you do?
Sure thing. Well, as you said, I'm fresh out of college, graduated with my mechatronics degree, and pretty quickly got myself into a contract for a four-month contract with a concept center working for Volvo. Mm-hmm. And that pretty much worked out great with not being able to find a full-time job but having full-time hours. So there's no definite continuation of this on what I'm going to do in the future, but a lot of people coming out in the engineering field right now are having a hard time finding jobs that relate to their degree. So this was a pretty great little selection.
Right. Now, is that common with the fellow classmates you had, or are your fellow graduates experiencing about the same level of difficulty in finding full-time employment?
It looks, from what I've seen, nobody else that I know has gotten into a contract or a free agent work like I did. Everybody's either spent a couple months after college looking for a job and finally finding one relating, or just going into whatever they can get their hands on.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now, does that relate? First off, could you explain what mechatronics is? I'm always kind of back and forth on what that is.
Yeah, mechatronics, it's a pretty new field. It's kind of a mix of mechanical, electrical engineering, and computer science. It devils mainly in control systems like machine automation, machine control, and robotic systems. So it's not
good,
too heavily
detailed. Company here
any.
For that kind of stuff. I mean, Jeff and I both like all that stuff, so that's great.
That's great stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you think it's because it's a newer field that maybe it's because of that? Like you said, that people are having a hard time, and yourself included, finding work in the field that they want versus just any kind of work. Is it maybe just the job market not catching up, or what do you think there?
That's definitely a problem. When I was coming up to graduate, I was talking to a lot of people that had just finished and trying to find out, what's the best way to go about this. Mm-hmm. And a lot of complaints are you go to a company and they don't know what mechatronic engineering is. So when you go to explain them to it, the mix of the three basic degrees, then they'll come back to you and say, oh, you don't have quite enough mechanical background, or you don't have quite enough computer background for what we want. So it can be a little tricky to find a job that integrates all three of those components, because if you go somewhere and they only want you for your computer science, you're not going to be that worth it because you haven't had too many classes on that one subject.
Right. More of a broad-based education across multiple fields versus being a singular, you know, silo of engineering and then having the broader liberal arts education or whatever else instead. And maybe you have that too. I don't even know. But that's an interesting mix.
I'm kind of curious when you talked with these people and they said, well, you didn't have quite enough ME or quite enough EE or CS. Were they talking about academic skills per se, or were they saying you just didn't have enough experience, you know, sort of hands-on experience they needed to offer you the job?
Well, this wasn't me talking to these people. These were other graduating seniors. But okay. From what I gathered with this was, when you're going into a field, say you're going into mechanical engineering, well, they want you to know Alias, they want you to know CATIA, they want you to know SolidWorks, they want you to know all the details leading into that field. And then when you get into the job, that's when you learn the very nitty-gritty specifics of what you're working on. But if you don't quite have that full background, they're going to spend the first 6 months training you anyway, and it can, if you don't work out, it's just a massive waste of money. So it's a big risk for them to pick you up if they're not sure you're qualified for your field.
We actually talked to that. We talked to a previous guest about recruitment, and he was actually on the experience side. He was a plastics recruiter. So, but he was recruiting experienced engineers, and we asked about younger engineers, and he said the same thing. You know, engineers these days companies these days are just so focused on, well, we need 4 years experience in Creo, PTC, and you know this and that, and it's just the unrealistic expectation that any kind of broad-based education would ever be able to offer you that experience, because you can't even keep up with it. And even if you could, you know, there's so many different iterations that you have to offer a broader swath and then hope that companies will educate, which obviously they're not.
it really is. I've been helping my friend try to find a job in the IT field, and we were looking at a job the other day, and it was entry-level technician wanted. Okay, entry-level. First qualification is minimum 2 years experience in Python, C++, HTML. Oh, and it's so where is the entry-level for people nowadays?
Right, exactly.
Right.
Well
it's a sign too of it's a sign too of the economy just not chugging along very strong, because if companies were to a point where they were just desperate to bring somebody in, I mean, we're losing money if we don't get the job done, they would be hiring a little more quickly and not sitting on the fence and looking and talking and debating like they seem to be doing.
Right. They'd be hiring physics majors, chemistry majors, biology majors, anyone they can get that even resembles engineering, they would try and pull them in, just like that happened in the, you know, the dot-com boom or, you know, back in other times.
Right.
That's the only one I got right now. Sorry.
Right.
There were others. Oh, I guess space race time, right? I mean, that would be another one.
Right. But, and we've talked about this in the past. A lot of it, you know, society is computerizing or automating a lot of the jobs that used to be there. And so I don't see that is going to get any better. I just don't think we're going to get into a period anytime soon where, you know, jobs are just plentiful for anybody who wants them.
Definitely. So you are a little bit different then. I mean, so I'm guessing many of your friends are looking for full-time employment. How did you even go about, did you even know what contract work was going in, or was it more of a stumble upon it kind of thing?
I had no idea what I was doing.
Oh, good. Just like us.
My second to last semester before I graduated, one of my friends up there, this girl Miranda, I knew her dad worked in the automotive industry, but I didn't know much about it. And I get a call one Saturday morning from her at like 8 a.m. and not very happy in the first place for that.
Yeah, right?
You know, Saturday morning you can put the pieces together. But I get a call and she says, you're a mechatronic engineer, right? And I say, yeah. And she says, okay, my dad's going to call you. I'm thinking, what's going on here?
So he's now.
Yeah. What's happening? So I get a call from him and he starts talking, and it turns out he's one of the engineers for the Volvo Monitoring and Concept Center. And he's come up with a project, and he wanted a mechatronic engineer to test it out. And there wasn't a massive budget for this project. It was just kind of one of those concept ideas. And he gave me the spiel on what he wanted and said, do you think you can do it? And I didn't think it was possible, but I said, yeah, definitely. I'll get that done for you.
Sure, no
you
problem.
You always say
yeah.
that. Jeff then is well-versed in quoting machines. He has no idea how to build yet.
That's how you got to do it nowadays.
Not just these days, my friend. It's been that's just engineering in general.
Is that fast?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, so I worked for them throughout that semester up in Chico, and wound up flying down once just to get some hands-on work, and finished up that contract. Got the job done reasonably, and then come the end of my last semester, they give me a call and say they want me to come do another contract. So here I am.
Wow. And so that kind of situation where you're still a student, that sounds very reminiscent of like a cooperative education type program. It's just in a very casual manner. Did your school have that kind of thing even? I mean, did you experience that, or was that more of a, is that not really a thing at your school?
It can be. My internship that I was working on before that job, and actually some of it during it, was a mechatronics internship with a mechatronics field at school, and we were designing robots for a certain government facility in California. So it was, they were kind of going out on a limb, helping out students, giving them work to do, not knowing exactly what's going to come out because, you know, we were students. And then, so that worked out very nicely to get kind of into the field and see what actually doing mechatronic work in the real world would be like.
Oh, okay. But that's not like a, have you ever heard of like established co-op programs?
Where
no. So that's basically like an internship, but it's actually you leave school for 7 months. And it depends where it is, you know, what the program is. But there's programs that I actually did two of these. That's how I know about it, where I left school for a whole semester and then a whole summer. It was paired together. And so I was gone for 7 months. I got paid like a, you know, a low end employee, not like low end, but I definitely got paid. And then I, you know, got all this experience. Then I went back to school and did rotations like that. So that's what I was kind of comparing it to. I don't know if Jeff, if you had any experience like that.
Yeah, when I was an undergrad, we had a co-op program that you could participate in. It wasn't mandatory. But you had the options. So I know that some schools, it's mandatory. I think Kettering Institute used to be GMI up in Flint, Michigan. It's mandatory.
And yeah, same with Cincinnati, I believe is.
Yeah, we talked in one of our early episodes, I think the third or fourth episode, with Jim Tappel at University of Cincinnati, who's involved with their engineering co-op program.
Yeah, so it sounds like you almost set up a ad hoc co-op program while you're in school. I mean, it was a contract, but that sounds very similar.
And, yeah, something of the sort.
So I mean, how did that play off? Was it like part time while you're in school, or was it actually full time?
For the Volvo subject.
Yeah, so for your first contract.
Okay, yeah, it was pretty much get the work done whenever you can and log the hours as you go. Mm-hmm. So really the majority of my time was spent walking through campus, drilling my brain, trying to figure out how I was going to get something done and not making much progress.
Right.
But it was the great thing about working for them, which worked really well with school, was there are no set hours. It was, if you get the work done, we're happy.
Nice. 24/7 access, that kind of thing. And
yeah,
that's great. That's really great. So, go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to ask, so how did they set you up for interfacing with the other engineering staff? Were you completely on your own, or did they say, hey, call, you know, Joe, he's the person to get a hold of, or how did you integrate your work with what was going on there already?
I was, the only guy I was actually in contact with was my friend's dad, who offered me the job or the contract in the first place.
Okay.
And as far as my end of it, I was all working on my own, and he was dealing with the mechanical interfacing with our system, because of course, being off base, I couldn't do that. So I'd do my software and do my 3D models and my plans, and then send them over to him, and he'd say, oh, this works, or this is useless, try again.
Okay.
Nothing like a mentor to really be honest with you, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's a part of engineering. You better get used to it that you know, a lot of the ideas just aren't going to work.
Well, yeah. I wanted to go back to what one thing you said there. I mean, it's an interesting concept. I mean, not particularly different, but you know, the effect of networking, really. I mean, you found this job through a friend whose father was looking for someone, and I was wondering if any of your other classmates have seen that kind of thing, because it is such a large part of finding jobs these days. I mean, versus looking at the online requirements that are ridiculous, like you mentioned.
That's a huge thing that I've noticed, is it's who you know. A couple of my friends have gotten jobs from either family that they've been in contact with and worked for that family business, or friends' family. I actually got one of my friends an engineering job with my dad's business. And because once you get into the field, I've learned it's who you know and how well you worked at your last job. So if you have experience, that's a huge thing, and if you know someone, that's even better.
Right. Yeah, I've written about that a lot, actually, about, you know, working through vendors and, you know, kind of building your network out like that. That's what ultimately got me my second and third job, was friends and network, and I'm surprised it worked at all, but it that's just how the world works, really. I mean, and I used to really be against it. I don't know how you feel about it, but or how do you feel about it, Stephen? I mean, like, is that conflict or no?
It's a little bit of a conflict, because there are those people, they just don't have connections where they need them, and it's rough because it's not so much fair for them. But at the same time, when you look at it from the company's end, if they're looking to hire somebody and they have 50 choices, and one of the people is a family friend or somebody that's been requested to work for them, it's much less of a gamble if you have people that have the background on the person. It's not as much of a wild card. So I can see it from both points of view. For me, it's worked out very well, so I can't complain.
Yeah, no, I think my own views match yours. I used to be very against it. You know, I used to think, oh, you know, it's a good old boys network, but it's really convenience and just getting people in, because like you said, like you alluded to earlier, you know, like, If you bring someone in, regardless of how good they are at calculus, right? If they don't know a software program, it's still going to take the person who's really good at calculus as the person who's really not as good at calculus. It's going to take them both 6 months probably to train up on something, right? That's the on the job training thing. And so, like you said, you know, take out that variable of, is this person going to chop me up to bits? and hopefully not. I think that is an important trade-off. I don't know. You know, I've thought about that a long time, how to get younger engineers that don't have the network built out. But my only answer is usually co-op, and as you said, you didn't even know what those were until today. So
yeah, I'd never heard of that before.
Yeah, and yeah, so it's an interesting problem to start facing.
So you have to be networking regardless. No, the world is not a meritocracy that everybody's rated on exactly how well they do their job. And even if you are fabulous at doing your job, nobody cares if they don't know about it. You know, you have to market yourself. You have to network, just no matter how good you are.
And that's something I've always tried to do, and it's turned out very helpful, is if I meet anybody in the field, anybody related to engineering, anybody related to something interesting to me, just spark up a conversation and see if you can dig into, you're not necessarily saying, hey, do you have a job for me, but finding out where they work. Hey, can you give me something to do? But you know, you find out where they work, what they're doing, and you get information on the field. And even if you don't get a specific contact, you kind of learn what more to ask about and what more to know about. Because when you go to interview with a company, you want to know details about that company. You don't want to just come in saying, oh, I want to do engineering for you.
Right. I was wondering, like, among you and your classmates, I know when I graduated in 06 and been working since, but back then LinkedIn wasn't that big, but it's a lot bigger now. And I was just wondering about the uptake of students using LinkedIn versus, you know, anyone else. Cause we did talk to that recruiter I mentioned earlier. He mentioned LinkedIn as a big thing. I know I get called through LinkedIn, you know, they just blind call, look people up and call them. And I was just wondering if you and your classmates are part of that kind of thing.
Almost everyone I knew in my field was using LinkedIn, especially towards the final year of college when, you know, you're going to job fairs, talking to potential companies, and a big thing to have on your resume is your LinkedIn, so they can get a little information about you and you can get contacts pushed through. I personally never set it up, mostly because I'm massively lazy, but worked out lucky for me.
Well, it's power networking. You get to sit on your bum. So can we move into just kind of how it transitioned? Because that's also interesting to me. I mean, obviously you did good work the first time. They called you back. But now this is full-time work. Is that right?
And yeah, and maybe, 40 hours a week.
Okay, so 40 hours a week. Is it like a – how long is the contract? I mean, I don't even know. I've never experienced any of this stuff personally.
It's – so I got pulled on tentatively for a 4-month contract. There's no technical end date, but this is when the project's due, and it's kind of you either have it done by then or you don't. And from so when I came in to do this, I'm working at the office there, working with all the full-time staff. I'm the only person that's contracted right now, but apparently they bring in contractors all the time because whenever they need somebody with a field specialty other than their own employees, they just go to contractors because it's easy.
Right.
And now it's just kind of up in the air. I'm working for them until I finish this set of projects and seeing what happens from there.
So what does that feel like? I mean, I guess that's my main question. I mean, I think Jeff has experienced this. Jeff was a machine builder for many years, and I've always had full-time jobs, though. I don't know what that the uncertainty feels like, minus the whole 2008 uncertainty if I'd have a job anyways.
It's a little bit unnerving. I'm not going to lie, because especially when you're down in an area like this where you don't want to be going into month-to-month rent because that's expensive, and I may be working in one town 1 month, and then after this contract maybe an hour and a half away. So that's so far been the most unnerving thing, because I hope I can get a job after this or get my contract extended, but even if I don't, it's having somewhere to be in the meantime. It's not that I wouldn't be able to afford a place to live in. It's just you can't go sign a 1-year contract or a 1-year lease on a 4-month contract.
Right, so you're saying that the rest of the world is not on the contract schedule so much.
Exactly, yeah. So that's the most frustrating bit of it.
Yeah, that is. So how have you been handling that? Did you actually sign a 1-year lease or no?
No, actually, one of the guys at Volvo, I'm staying with him right now, just because finding a month to month for 4 months is massively expensive in the LA area, and there's an extra room, so we figured why not.
Yeah, that works out nice. Another value of networking there.
Yeah, wonderful situation.
Yeah.
Right. When I was on working for myself, I know that a common problem was trying to find the next job was tough. You're embroiled in solving the current problem, and there seems no time to go out and market and network and find out what's out there and what opportunities are out there. Are you able to do any of that, Stephen?
At this moment, looking into other jobs, I've mainly been talking to people where I work. So if I'm looking for my next contract, a lot of people there, they've worked in multiple different fields, in multiple different industries, and they have a lot of knowledge. And even if it's just a company name and an email address of somebody that's there, that's enough to get you in the door. Because when you send them an email and say, hey, I know Joe Schmo from this place, he said I should look into you for this field of engineering or whatever you're doing. Right. And that, because then that's when you get a response from them, whether you get a job from them or not, but you're much more likely to get that email back or that phone call back saying, hey, we want to talk to you. Because even though you don't really know that person personally, having that reference is hugely helpful.
Yeah, that's sure. That's actually the basis of, I don't know if you've ever read it, but What Color Is Your Parachute, which is the classic on finding jobs. You directly describe networking and as his definition. That's pretty, well, pretty brilliant. So you're doing it right according to Richard Bowles.
That's good to know.
Yeah, keep it up.
Right. Right. And our recruiting expert, Jim Heilman, when he was on, he basically said the same thing, that networking was really key.
Yeah. Well, that's tough too, because I remember hearing networking is key when I was a student, but I was just like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, like it's just a word, right? But when someone sits down, like, and if Steven describes it like he did, you know, actually making these connections and, you know, trying to extend your who you've talked to, right? That right. is networking. It's nothing more, really. You can do that at, you know, I always used to imagine cocktail parties, right? Schmoozing. Oh, you know,
right.
What is the weather today? You know, it's like, that's not necessarily what it is. It's genuine interest in what these people are doing and trying to find out, you know, how you can help them. And in a non-pushy manner, I'm sure, Steven, you're not like, what do you need?
I try not to be.
Yeah, that's good.
Right. So well, Chris, I know you like schmoozing, talking about sports so much. So
oh, I do. Yeah, just like that that recent XKCD comic, which has a nice handy chart of what season it is and what you can talk about.
Right.
No, that could be massively helpful.
It is very good translation for the non-sports fans out there like me.
Right.
So you mentioned before that this is a facility that has both full-time and sometimes part-time or sometimes contract, but not many right now other than you.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any noticeable differences in, you know, like how you're treated or what information you're allowed to see or, you know, security clearance on networks and stuff like that?
Without going into too much detail.
Right, sorry. What is your password?
No, you don't really have access to anything, but it's all done through non-disclosure agreements. So okay. When you're working there, you can get whatever information you need. They really don't hold you back with what they don't want people to know, unless it's massively secret. But
okay.
For the most part, people treat you pretty much just like another employee, and it's kind of nice because they're exceptionally open to helping you or giving you a hand with something because you are new there. So you're kind of a fresh face and they're interested because you're in a specific field. It's not something they see every day what's going on. So they're kind of interested in what you're doing, which can really help you meet people and figure out how to get stuff done.
Yeah. That is interesting, is like having the niche skill set that others don't. I think that almost touches more on consultant than it does contract. I mean, I know that you're there for an extended period of time and there's like weird definitions between the two, but you know, having that specific skill set, you're not just like a hired grunt. You're actually, you know, you're a specific, you're offering something that they just couldn't get otherwise.
Technically, I am a consultant for them.
Oh, okay.
That's the first project that I did for them when I was in school. I was going to be an intern, but technically the way it works, because they're benefiting from my knowledge and not the other way around, even though it basically was the other way around. They had to call me. Yeah. Keep that one secret. They had to call me a consultant and not an intern.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That seems to fit with the definition I have in my mind. I don't know if Jeff, if you have any different takes on that. I've always been kind of confused.
I'm sorry, confused about which?
Just as like the differences between consultants and contractors, or if you even delineate between the two.
Well, more often when somebody talks about a contractor, they're talking about somebody who's been brought in to be given guidance by the company. They're being told, I mean, it comes back to the whole benefit stuff. So if you bring in someone as a contractor, they're going to be considered an employee of the company by the IRS. Regardless of whether you give them full-time benefits or not. Mm. Whereas if you come in as a consultant, the idea is that you get to decide what you're going, you know, you're pretty much in charge of what you're going to do, what hours you work, you provide your own tools for the job. And so I think it has more to do with a financial, economic, legal definition more than it does what gets done. And a lot of times the person who comes in as a consultant and the person who comes in as a contractor may be doing exactly the same thing. One gets paid better, but also one is taking a risk. One hasn't signed typically a consultant will sign a job contract. And so it goes, they're signing up to perform some job for a certain amount of money. As opposed to a contractor who's usually brought in on an hourly or weekly basis, and they're paid on you know, they will know they're going to get paid 40 hours a week for so many weeks to finish out the contract.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I wanted to talk more about the concept of this is a broader topic. I mean, Stephen, I'm not sure if you said you don't have any other friends that are doing this kind of thing right now, right?
No, not that I know of.
And I know a couple of people that have been contractors in the past, but I mean, what do you think going forward? I mean, maybe we should just talk about yourself first. I mean, what do you think about, you know, continuing to do this kind of thing? Is this a favorable job situation for you, or is it more of a hold off until you could find a permanent job that you'd be comfortable in?
In my current position, I think it's kind of a hold off until I can find myself a comfortable permanent or semi-permanent job. Mm-hmm. But if this was something down the road, and I had more contacts, it could be something very fruitful, because if you know enough companies and you have your foot in enough doors, doing contract work could be great. It could get you moving around. You get paid well enough, hopefully, and you get to experience a lot of different fields, which in turn could help in a long-term job because you're a really well-rounded employee. So to answer your question, in the current moment, it's kind of just something to do until I can find a steady job, because coming out of college, getting to a whole new world of living on your own without roommates and setting yourself up 401k and all these things that I don't know what they mean. Right. It'd be nice to have a base, something that's stationary and permanent that you can revolve around.
Right. No, I think that's understandable. The point I was getting towards was with the future of work. I mean, really, that's ultimately the question is, you know, whether this will become a bigger trend or if it's, you know, more isolated. Jeff, you said that you've read a book you've kind of seen this discussed. Is that right?
Yeah, there was Daniel Pink, who's recently written the book Drive that I think we talked about last week, where people were motivated by autonomy and purpose, and I can't remember what the last one was we talked about
mastery.
Last week, but mastery. But in 2001, he wrote a book called Free Agent Nation, where he talked about this growing trend of people leaving the full-time employment world, some of them because they had to, some of them because their jobs were eliminated, and some of them because they just couldn't stand working for a big company anymore. They were tired of the bureaucracy and wanted to try something new.
So and so that was a bigger trend because of the prosperity at the time, but maybe not so much in the interim.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I'm reading the book right now, and it was written in 2001, right before the dot-com boom. So some of the things that they talk about then, some of the opportunities that were there then are not quite the same as they are now.
Work for Enron.
Right. Right. But he talked about, I mean, some of the things he talks about are very valid. You're almost more secure if you're working at least for a small company, because you have the opportunity to diversify your interest. You're not working for IBM your entire career, where if IBM decides that they don't need your services anymore, you're stuck. You've spent a little time with company A and a little time with company B and a little time with company C. And if you're good enough to be welcomed into all those companies and to find work on a regular basis, then that's great job security. That's better job security than having a single employer who may or may not 15 years down the road decide that, you know, your division is not needed anymore.
Right. So this is the topic that Stephen will get into when he starts doing the 401k stuff and diversification of investments, right?
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it's definitely a different mindset. I know this, you know, from going out on business on my own. Some days you wake up and you don't have anything there. You know, there's nothing but to go start calling on people, picking up the phone, seeing what they got going. And fortunately, you do that enough, eventually something comes along. But you can spend some pretty sleepless nights wondering where is that next job going to come from. It's not necessarily awful, but it's not a comforting feeling. And not everybody is made to handle that on a regular basis.
Right. And you know, we kind of touched on this a little bit before, but also there's the whole, the other stuff of jobs, right? The the pay and the benefits and everything else. And we won't ask Stephen what he's getting paid or anything. But I think it is an interesting discussion in the U.S. at least about healthcare. And so obviously a lot of people depend on healthcare through their employer, but I don't think contractors usually get that kind of thing. Is that right?
No, they generally don't.
Okay. So are you self-insuring? Is that kind of the idea? If you don't mind us asking, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, I'm still lucky enough to be on my parents' insurance plan because of my age. But that is actually one of the biggest considerations for down the road is if I get a full-time proper job, you're on their benefits and their healthcare, hopefully. And that can be a huge savings and a nice security for you. And then once you have a family, which I think up until the point where you're settled down into a family, doing that contract one to another job can work really well because you can get that good pay. You can get in 7 months what you'd make in 12 months usually, and then you have 3 months to relax and find yourself your next project. But at the same time, you could be moving around a lot, so it can be very off.
Right, right. Don't forget to pay taxes too. I don't know if you have
I'll try to remember that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you get paid, but I've been paid as a W-9 employee before, and that's a big shift as well. What is that one? Is it W-9? The one where you're getting paid as a 1099 rather.
1099.
Yeah, you're getting paid as a no taxes withheld, so you have to kind of watch your dollars and keep it in the bank and prepay if you're making enough, and that's just a big old pile of junk.
Hopefully I have to never have to think about that much.
Yeah, it's different because there's ups and downs to it too. I'm sure Jeff has experienced this as well. When you get paid for a consulting job, like where it's just a chunk of money, right, they'll give you a 1099 at the end of the year. If you're not on the payroll or anything like that, they say, okay, I paid you $2,000 and basically here's your receipt for the IRS, right, and you need to report all that stuff. Well, the downside is you have to pay some amount of tax on that in the U.S., and it's not taken out, so you're paying it either way. But the upside then is there's also deductions. So for business deductions, if you're driving to your job now, that is actually a business deduction, as far as I know. I don't want to say anything that I am not a lawyer, but but yeah, there are some benefits there that you can take advantage of. So it's kind of like a balancing act. So it's I'm sure Jeff experienced this as well.
Right. But I will mention that I got caught the first year that I started doing consulting work on the side where I didn't pay taxes and got caught at the end of the year. It's like, they're going, you owe us and you owe us
20 grand
because you haven't paid.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite that much, but it was enough to get my attention.
Yeah.
One thing I will say is if you're doing this, And Steven, I don't know how you've got your finances worked out, but check to see if you need to be paying quarterly taxes. Because oftentimes if you're doing contract work and they're not taking the taxes out, you do have to pay quarterly taxes and you get hit with penalties if you don't pay on a regular basis.
Yeah. That is it's a very interesting point. That's something they really don't teach you in school. I had an engineering economics class and we learned about when to sell your company trucks. So it's the tax write-offs are just right,
Right.
Is that part of the professional engineering exam or the engineering in training exam or whatever as well?
Oh, actually, I'm not. It might be one of the wonderful things about a mechatronic engineer is I don't have to take the PE test.
Yeah, I didn't either, but I did. Like an idiot. Yeah, there's an economics section. Maybe it matches up, maybe it doesn't. But it's a lot of little arrows you draw, and it tells you all the. All the accounting stuff that you never thought you needed to know. I've never heard of a class about that though. That's nice. So they didn't go over the finer points of the one guy in class that's going to be a contractor.
No, they left me specifically out, probably just for spite purposes. But what are you gonna do?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of interesting resources out there for people that are thinking about this kind of thing as well, and maybe for you, Steven, as well. I find that it dovetails nicely when you have a personal finance writer who's a freelancer because they like writing about money and then they like writing about their own money and then they happen to be writing about their own tax situation. So that's usually a good source of information trying to find freelance writers. They often complain about quarterly taxes just like I do. So But yeah, it's a whole weird world that, I mean, you know, I ended up learning about this stuff from a friend who was, you know, running a business, and I ended up in getting an LLC, and because through him, I learned that, you know, I could even do that, and that's just a weird thing you can do when when you're a one man band like you are. So
yeah, it's getting out and getting a job is a lot more than just getting out and getting a job, I'm starting to learn.
I mean, you are taking an unconventional path, which is why we wanted to talk to you. I mean, we think it is really interesting that you did this out of school, because you don't hear that very often. And if there's any other listeners out there that are doing the same, I'd be very interested in the trend of this, because I think it's increasing. I think it's going to even more so in the future, because, you know, you came out of school with this specialized degree, but I think that I personally think that as more and more people retire, you know, the workforce is we've talked about before, is not really there. We talked to a bunch of guys that were doing STEM stuff and trying to prepare the next generation of engineers. There's not necessarily the same numbers, and that's actually an economic boon for people like us, you know, like, because you can specialize and you can charge a little bit more because you're the only one who knows how to do it. So and you get to see that now, right?
Yeah, that is, for anybody, I would highly recommend going this path, because when I was getting into this, my biggest view was, oh, it's only 4 months, but resume. It's a huge resume builder, especially showing that you're able to come in, get something done, get it on time, and get it out. And you're getting experience in fields you generally wouldn't, because when companies bring you in for something like this, like you said, it's very specialized. You're kind of the only one doing it, and it's trial by fire. You're coming in, you're learning a lot, and you're moving out. And if you can handle it, which, you know, it's really not that terrible of a thing, it can be very useful, hopefully.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Hey, Steven, when you were interviewing for these jobs, let me back up. Did you have to interview for this contract job, or did they know you and so you kind of got it based on your prior work?
It was kind of a half interview, half just chat with that initial phone call. It was probably an hour and a half or 2 hours of talking about what I've been doing with my previous work, so he could kind of get an idea of what I know and what my specialties are and what I could do with the project they wanted me to work on. So it wasn't necessarily really an interview, but it kind of was.
Okay. Did you go on any other interviews while you were getting out of school?
No, this was, I got this job offered to me about 2 months, 3 months before I graduated. Okay. And I was getting my resumes ready to send out everywhere. And then I got the call saying, do you want to come back and work again? And I said, yes. And that's all she wrote.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask, I'm still interested in knowing whether engineering interviews use all the crazy questions I read about on for the computer science guys. You know, how many basketballs can you stuff in a bus? And, you know,
you have a coconut, a piece of tape, and 14 paper clips. Swim off a desert island.
Actually, my internship that I was working with at school before I got this contract,
right?
The interview, I did two interviews like that. The first time I didn't get it, and then a year later I came back and interviewed again and I got the job. And it was that kind of engineering where they're trying to dig into how you think and what your thought processes are. Okay. And those questions you read about, they're not bogus. They really ask those, and they really will stump you.
See, now I think it's actually meant for the as an interviewer myself, I really think it's for the interviewer to just keep them occupied after asking the same questions over and over again. I'm sure they do stump people. I've never asked them myself, but I'm sure it's more to watch people squirm, because I tell you what, if you go into, especially when you go recruiting at schools and you hear about the same project that the intro class works on for the 12th time, I tell you what, you are ready to talk about just about anything else. You know, you talk about what color socks they have on instead of that, because it's not great.
If that is the purpose, it definitely worked, because I can tell you I was squirming when I was getting all those.
Right. Yep. Yeah, that is. I'm not sure if it's a. So I guess it's not just software, you know. And I guess it is all manner of employers, but I don't. I wouldn't do it personally. I'd rather try and ask other questions. I mean, so, and one of the other questions I do ask is hobby activities. I mean, is there stuff that you were doing outside of school that that allowed you to, you know, kind of stand out as well?
You know, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. I learned this with my interview for my original internship, and just before I'd done that, I had rebuilt the engine in my car because I'd managed to, well, melt part of it. And I was writing up my resume, and there's so much stuff you want to put on there, and you try to specialize it for the job you're going for, and you don't. It's hard to figure out what goes in there. And I was thinking, well, I rebuilt my engine. We're building robots. I'm not going to be tearing something apart and tolerancing them and doing this and that. But then when I was talking to him, he started digging into what are my hobbies? What do I do in my free time? And little things like that, well, big things, rebuilding your engine, little things like, oh, you like to do networking on your computer. You set up your voice chat for your friends when you play video games. Those little things show your what you've been able to do and what you've been able to learn on your own. And when he learned about my engine, he said, well, why didn't you mention that? And I said, well, I didn't think it related to building robots. And he said, it means, well, when you design a part in 3D modeling and you send it to the manufacturer, you know what having a tolerance of plus or minus 5 thousandths means, because you've right. put your hands on it. And my dad always told me this thing. It's you can tell somebody exactly what happens when you strip the head off a bolt, but you'll never know when it's going to happen until you've done it 10 times. So when you're showing them what you do and what you've done, it can really be a huge help on getting that job.
Yeah. That's interesting, because we, Jeff, what episode? It was 2 episodes ago where we, no, it was last episode. We were talking about ethics and right. basically how in certain situations you cannot describe something because the words just don't exist for it until you have the vocabulary for something, or in this case, like the experiential, you know, situation. You don't know how to describe something really, and in this right. in this case, it is the actually doing the stripping of the bolt that actually allows you to you know, describe it to someone else. So that's a very good point. Personally, I always you know, I've said this for since I started interviewing people. Especially with students, not as much for you know, experienced people, but with students, I read from the bottom up, because I can tell within 10 seconds if someone's cares about electronics, at least, you know, by what other stuff they have on there outside of their class stuff. So
do people get that far through engineering school and they don't care about engineering?
Definitely. There are a lot of kids that are in there, and I said, why did you choose it? And they said, well, because I was good at math, or because it has good pay, or because my dad wanted me to. And that can make a huge difference in what kind of an engineer someone. Sure, if you can do all the equations and you have them all in your head, that's great. But unless you're somebody that's kind of doing it on your own and learning it because you want to do it and actually getting the concepts down rather than just the facts, can make a big difference.
That's good. Right. I totally agree with you.
So go ahead.
I was just going to ask, you know, longer term. I mean, since we're into the interview mode, where do you see yourself in 5 years, Steven? Oh, doesn't everybody love that question?
Oh yeah.
Let me jump in. The old answer was they wanted to hear, well, I'm going to be in the same company moving up 5 years from now.
Right. I will be a manager in 5 years. And interestingly, that's what they say overseas. That's India, right? Engineers mm-hmm. are not regarded nearly as much as managers. They say engineering is a path to management.
Right, right. So the old days, you'd say, I expect to be here and moving up. But in the, now, what do we say, Stephen? What's your response to it?
Well, actually, for me, I've been wanting to – my view with this is getting into these little niche jobs. When you go somewhere and there's a go-to guy for networking, or there's a go-to guy for the door hinge, or there's a go-to guy for glass manufacturing. My goal is where I want to be in 5 years is to not be the go-to guy for that necessarily, because right. that could be annoying, and that'd be, you know, just way above my mental abilities to know all that stuff. But just knowing the basics and concepts of everything I can know about what interests me, Because not only can that help you get a good job because you have a background in a variety of things, but it keeps your interest going. You're not designing the nut that holds the wheel on 10,000 times throughout your career.
You're expert at it. You're a nut expert.
Yeah. don't want to be that nut expert. I want to be kind of the general guy and know a lot because I know it's what's fun for me, and I managed to be lucky enough to get into a field that I enjoy.
Yeah. And that I think that is a larger trend as well, because you know, we see like on the electronics side, at least, I mean, and you probably see this as a mechatronics person, you know, electronics used to be a very siloed thing. You know, like if you were a microcontroller guy, that's all you did because that's all you could do. And because it took so long. And these days there's so much abstraction and there's so much, you know, pre-built boards that you can just plug into and go, that electronics is expanding as a field because of it. But also because of that, you know, there's less need for the super pigeonholed people. You know, they always will be needed in smaller circles, but you know, more people can get into it and be interested in it and have this broad base of information. And I've seen that as a trend, and again, I'm with you on that one. I like being a generalist personally because it's more fun. I mean, I don't know.
Oh yeah,
somebody has to be an expert though, right?
Well, yeah, you, Jeff, the PhD, have to.
God.
Sorry.
Oh, I know nothing about it, very little, and know a lot about nothing. I don't know. I mean, the whole idea of a PhD is trying to find a very narrow niche and dig really deeply into that niche. But I certainly think that some days that you get so deep into that niche, you just know nothing about anything.
So, Steven, you ready to go back for a PhD yet?
No, not quite yet.
Well, Jeff's in, what is it, education as well, Jeff? That's what you're doing?
Well, it's a regular engineering PhD, but I went back to school for the purpose of teaching in the engineering classroom.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I could see that though. I mean, I'm also curious just to kind of, the general feeling of your classmates as well. What's the take on just entrepreneurship and starting companies? I mean, you're in California, but you're in Chico, which isn't necessarily like this. That's LA, right? Not Silicon Valley. So
Chico's up Northern California.
Northern California.
Yeah.
That tells you how much I know from my perch in Ohio, my flat perch.
Well, actually, the whole entrepreneurship, there's in this engineering field, I saw very little of it, probably partly because of the economy, because people are scared to go out and try to make their own company. And a big thing was there's like the entrepreneurial program at the school. I'm sure most schools have that. And I don't know how many times I had some of my friends that are business majors or marketing majors come up to me and say, I have this great idea. I want you to engineer this for me. And then they give me this rundown of what it is. And I'm like, that's physically not possible. You can't make that happen. So you get berated with all these ideas, and it's, well, I just want to go work for somebody that knows what they're doing, because I'm an engineer. I know engineering. Don't ask me to do marketing. Don't ask me to do PR, because I'm going to fail miserably.
Yeah.
We just need that perpetual motion machine, and then we'll have it made.
Oh, exactly. I got it. I'm working on it. I'll have you something in a few days.
Yeah, that's interesting hearing the feel for that, because you know it's like pockets here and there, and like you said, there are programs everywhere now, and I'm interested in it, but it's, you know, it's like you said, you know, like sometimes you just want to be able to build stuff that you know how to build, and instead of just these nebulous, far out ideas that you know won't work.
Yeah, I wish I could remember right now, but there's a website out there that what you do is you come to them with, here's my idea, here's my plans for it, if you're engineering basis or whatever, and they'll bring in the rest of the people needed to help you move that forward.
Is that Quirky?
It could be, yes.
That's the socially sourced site. You put in your you put in your idea, people vote on it, the top voted ideas then, you know, get developed by some of their internal people, and then they put it back to the community, and they go all the way through the development process.
Yeah, from what I've read, that'd be so nice, because then you're still doing your field, you're doing what you enjoy and what you're specialized in or trained in, and then there are other people to do, well, their specializations and trainings.
Mm. Well, it's not all bad to be taken out of your realm of comfort, though. I mean, sometimes you get into a project and there's just nobody else to do it, and you have to dive in and discover something new. And even though it's uncomfortable and frustrating and seems like a waste of time at first, you usually gain a little momentum, gain some understanding, and you've added another tool to your toolkit.
Yeah, that is very, very true, actually. That's one of the, not complaints, but the hard parts of doing this contracting or consulting work is when I go in there and I'm specialized in my field, they're expecting you to know it. And if you don't know how to do something, you better know how to figure out how to do it, because there's nobody there that has any idea how to do it.
Right.
And you also get to practice the time-honored tradition of fake it till you make it.
Exactly. Google is your friend.
That's right. In IT and all things.
Right.
That's great.
Well, Stephen, as a relative newcomer to the engineering workforce, have you been surprised at all about what engineers do or the engineers that you work with? I guess you were already doing this some on your own before you took this latest contract.
To a certain extent, yes. It's kind of like when people ask me, do you do much math? I say, I can barely do addition anymore, because what they train you for and what you do in a job are so very different. There are the certain people that there's a guy that sits behind his computer doing CATIA work, and he's really, really good at it. And he sits there and he puts components and models together, and that's his kind of job. Mm-hmm. And then there are guys that all they're doing is kind of the artsy engineering design. And then there's guys like me that are kind of doing the specialized work. And that whole nitty-gritty engineering that you always hear about and you think about when you're a kid, I haven't seen a lick of that. I'm not sure that's a real thing. I think it might be made up.
So is it not getting done? It's got to be getting done someplace. Is it all embodied in the computer software?
Well, it is getting done. Yeah, part of it is just the computers do so much for you nowadays. If you know how to use the software, that gets you miles ahead. People get jobs solely because they know how to use CATIA or they know how to use SolidWorks or something like that. But right. Also there are other departments, like within where I'm working, since I'm at a concept center, we have that helicopter view. We're not designing a component or a system that's going to go be put in a car and sold. We're designing the proof of concept. We're designing the showcase item. And then you send it over to R&D, and they're the ones sitting there cranking out how to make this bracket with a factor of safety of 2.5 and a cycle time of 10 million cycles. That's right. There's that nitty-gritty engineering over there, but in kind of the field I'm in, there's nobody doing it.
So are there any aspects of the engineering world that you've taken a real shine to? You've gone, this is the part of the job that is really cool. This is what I signed up for.
Yeah, what I've really figured out I love is just the problem solving. When you get into your project, and it may not be just a computer project or a software project or an electrical project, but you're trying to figure out how to work all these things together, and a hiccup comes up, and you need to find some either efficient or inefficient, complex, pretty or simple or ugly or whatever way to make it around, but you have to mm-hmm. make that system work. And that's where I feel I really, even though I'm not the greatest at it, I really enjoy doing it, because it lets your mind get a bit creative, and you're not just making two components mesh properly. You're
right.
You're putting everything together with a helicopter kind of view.
Right. And mm-hmm. and do your concepts get treated with appropriate respect from your older engineering peers there?
Yeah, they definitely do. That's one of the things that's great about this place. Some of the stuff I'm working on has been my idea that I said, hey, look, let's try this out and see what we can do. And they said, sure, run with it. And then other ones are, I was working with a certain component, a certain new technology, actually. And one of the guys from the human interface came down and said, hey, I like this. What if we did this with it? Mm-hmm. So then you work kind of with them, and you plug out your end of it, and Some of it gets put, you get the whole system developed and you look at it and you say, that's really cool. I want to do something with this. Let's get it patented and move it forward. And other times you do it and you say, hey, that's neat. Good try, but let's move on to something else. But all in all, it's very, everybody enjoys doing this. So it's a very warm place to work with new concepts and ideas, because nothing's considered stupid, even if it might be mildly idiotic.
So there's permission to fail, that kind of
There's
thing.
definitely permission to fail. Try not
That's
to, but
good. That's good in a consulting role as well, because sometimes, you know, when you're expected to deliver, it's not always as explicit as, you know, it's okay to fail. You know, sometimes it's, we're paying you. You must succeed. You know, so that's, you could tell you're on an hourly contract instead of a instead of a fixed bid contract, you know.
Yeah.
Otherwise you'd be the first thing that remotely looks like it works, then you throw it.
Yeah, as long as you, the big thing is delivering something that does, you know, meet their basic requirements. And then sometimes just, hey, that's, you know, that was a good idea, but in practical application, it's awful. So now we learn something more, and we could either run with it in one direction and try something new, or just say, okay, that was fun. We learned not to do that and do something
Yeah.
else.
Right. So Stephen, we're kind of winding down time here, but I'm wondering, both you and your classmates, I mean, I've always been a proponent of like keeping blogs and online presences, but I mean, do you or your classmates, did you have any semblance of like professional online presences?
Not for me so much. There's a couple people I know that this did this website where they do online resumes, and you can have videos and descriptions of what you've done, because as an engineer, putting everything you do on one page is not very good. And you can kind of have a running blog of all your either home or professional products that you can show to people. And from the people I've talked to, they've really enjoyed that, and it can be helpful when you go to a company and say, look what I've done, and you're not just handing them a packet, because a packet of paper is kind of intimidating. I don't want to waste my time reading that, but
Right,
you send them to a
exactly.
website with some neat videos of something doing something. That's kind of cool.
Right, yeah, project videos and that kind of idea. That's good. I mean, obviously you've been on a podcast now, so that
Yeah,
helps, you know,
this is another step.
point people here.
Cool.
What Another
about
checkbox on the online marketing presence.
Yeah, there you
Hey,
go.
I gotta drop my laziness in that era.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's a good way to expand your, you know, your if you think of your I'm actually reading a book right now called The Startup of You, and it's by Reid Hoffman, the guy that started LinkedIn. And basically his assertion is that, you know, basically if everyone treats their job, you know, if they're in a full-time position or contract position or anything else, if they treat it as though, you know, it's a startup, and you know, you need to market your skills, and you need to, you know, develop, you know, you need to have R&D going on a regular basis, you know, in your own life. You need to try out new things. I really like that idea, and I think that it fits well with a lot of the tools that are out there today for, you know, blogging and, you know, keeping online presences.
Yeah, I do very much agree with that. It's a new technology to take advantage of, and you know, why not? If it can help you, if it can help you get a job, if it can help you learn about people or learn about new technologies, why not?
Well, and if we continue to move towards this idea of a free agent nation where more and more jobs are temporary, and not, you know, I think we're past the era. I think my generation was probably the last that could expect to come out of school and work for a company for 20 or 30 years. You know,
Right.
I know it will happen, but I think it's going to become less and less. And in that era, in a time where, you know, you're moving from project to project as opposed from job to job, you need that presence. You need to have that connection. You need to be networking. You need to know what's out there and who you're competing against. So all good reasons to maintain that online presence.
So, Stephen, is there anywhere people can find you? Maybe LinkedIn or Twitter or anywhere else if they need a mechatronics engineer?
Actually, at the current time, just my email. I haven't really got anything else set up.
Okay, that's okay. Well, we'll post that later if you're comfortable with it, or if not, people can get in contact through the comments of this episode as well.
And no,
And they can.
feel free.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate, you know, this is a really good context for, you know, younger engineers and you know, what they're experiencing moving into the workforce and your situation seems really interesting and exciting, actually.
Cool. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I think you've got yourself nicely positioned. I hope you find the full-time job you're looking for, but if not, it looks like you've got a skill set that will keep you in demand for some time.
That's a hope.
All right, well, thank you again, Steve.
Thank you very much, yeah.
The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision, in association with Engineering.com. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.